The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
With the formation of UWM's new School of Freshwater Science and the Joseph Zilber School of Public Health, UW-Milwaukee has become uniquely equipped to study some of the most important scientific and environmental problems facing society today. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to focus on one of those issues, the problem of emerging contaminants that could put our freshwater supply at risk. Joining us in the studio is Rebecca Clapper, Associate Professor in the School of Freshwater Science, and Todd Miller, Assistant Professor of Environmental and Occupational Health at the Zilber School of Public Health. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And the two of you work in similar areas, even though you're in different schools. And I guess that's one of the great things about what's happening at UWM today, the whole notion of interdisciplinary research, people really crossing the borders and talking about problems that in the past might have been only studied in one school or the other. Rebecca, why don't we begin with you and talk about this whole notion of these emerging contaminants. This is an issue that maybe 10 or 15 years ago, 20 years ago, people weren't even thinking about.
Emerging contaminants as a term is a little bit nebulous, but it basically are chemicals that fall into two different categories. They're either new chemicals that are brand new on the marketplace, like nanomaterials, or chemicals that we have only recently, within the last decade or so, been able to measure out in the environment because we have new chemical methods. And so they're basically new to us as far as an environmental problem because of either one of those two reasons.
And you've been looking at the introduction of these contaminants specifically in freshwater. All of your work focuses right now in the water arena, if you will.
Yeah, we've been looking at the effects of nanomaterials and all sorts of different pharmaceuticals and some personal care products on aquatic organisms, and also measuring them going out into Lake Michigan in particular, looking to see what we find coming out of our sewage treatment plants and what ends up out in the environment.
I want to bring Todd into the conversation because, Todd, you're relatively new to Milwaukee, to UWM at least, about a year and a half at the new School of Public Health. And your focus is looking at the same sort of thing in terms of products that we might be using on ourselves, on our bodies.
Right. Among the many products that we do use every day and flush down the drain, personal care products contain a number of chemicals that enter the environment. They don't get broken down during wastewater treatment and end up in our lakes and rivers. And so we're looking at where these chemicals occur and how bacteria in wastewater treatment can do a better job of breaking them down.
Before we talk about the whole notion of these nanoparticles and these tiny things floating around, tell our listeners why they should care. Why is this important that we know what's happening with the deodorant that's washing off our body or the hormones that are washing through us as a result of medication we might be taking?
A lot of the chemicals that we're talking about here have they've been designed to act at very low doses. And so the fact that they occur out in the environment at these low doses is of concern because it might impact things like fish that are vertebrates like we are, have similar physiological pathways, and might have the same kind of impacts on them. And if you look at, for example, one of your pill bottles, you'll see the different side effects that might happen if you take a particular medication. Well, those same side effects might happen in some of the organisms that you see out in the environment. And Todd has a little different perspective because he says different types
Sure.
of critters.
I could add to that. I think why people should care about this is because it really increases the costs associated with drinking water treatment. As these things build up in the environment, we have to design newer and better strategies to make sure that we're removing these compounds so they don't get into drinking water. Now, I don't have any evidence that they are in our drinking water now, but if we allow them to continue polluting the environment, then we may have to design better strategies.
And of course, here in Milwaukee, what better place to be concerned about what's in our drinking water, given the history some time ago, fortunately, of Cryptosporidium and little microbes, little organisms that I don't think anybody even knew existed, or most of us didn't know existed, until thousands, tens of thousands of people got sick drinking water that had the contaminant in them. Rebecca, as you think about Lake Michigan, which is the source for drinking water for a good chunk of our listeners, not all of them. There's some in Waukesha who would love to be drinking fresh water from Lake Michigan, and that may still happen down the road as that debate or discussion plays out. But looking out at the lake, it's an awfully big place, you know, with a billions or trillions of gallons of water that we have in there. Is there any evidence right now in the research that you've been doing that as big as the lake is, there still could be a buildup of these contaminants?
Yeah, from the research, and actually we just submitted a paper on this just last week, looking at some of the measurements that we've made going out a few miles out into the lake, away from where you would anticipate any of the sewage effluent to be going. And we find definitely that there are much higher concentrations of certain of the pharmaceuticals than we would have expected going that far out in the lake, given the way the lake moves, water patterns, and that kind of thing. And also a buildup in the sediments in the lake as well. So there are certain compounds that we probably need to be paying closer attention to, and that may be making it to our drinking water. We don't necessarily have the data on that yet. But
what kind of particles, what kind of substances are you finding at this point?
We're finding some of the medications that people take most often, or some of the things that they consume most often. So, for instance, caffeine is something that almost everybody consumes in our population, and we find that going out into the lake in a pretty significant amount, even though the sewage treatment plant is able to take out a good portion of it, because we consume so much of it and there's so much of it going into the treatment plant, not all of it's removed and it goes out into the lake. We find breakdown products from people that are smoking cigarettes. Cottonine is a breakdown product of nicotine. We find that going out in the lake. And then there are certain pharmaceuticals for some of the common diseases that people have, diabetes, some of the depression medications and other things.
High blood pressure medication and the like?
Yeah, that are ending up, that don't get broken down all the way by the treatment plant and end up out in our lake and go pretty far out into the lake, farther than we expected.
What about hormones? You know, birth control pills, the estrogen or testosterone treatments that people take? Any evidence that that is sticking around after we flush it away?
Yeah, that's definitely gotten a lot of press around the country because we see things like intersex fish and problems with the sexual function of fish out in the environment. And there's a thought that it's due to the hormones that are coming out of the treatment plant. And we find small amounts of a couple of the testosterone and like hormones coming out. And the thing is about those is that even though we're finding them at really tiny levels, or sometimes we don't find them at all because they're below what we call the detection limit of our capabilities of our instruments, that low level, even below the detection limit of our instrument, they're still active out in the environment. And so it's a problem even if we can't measure it.
I've had the great pleasure of touring your laboratories, and I've seen that zebrafish are being used in research by you or by some of your colleagues because those fish have a lot of wonderful qualities, as I understand it.
Yeah.
Not only are they practically transparent, but they are very, very sensitive to the way in which contaminants or chemicals affect them. Any evidence in your research so far on aquatic life, if even small amounts of these contaminants are having some sort of perceived effect?
Yeah, so again, another paper that we just submitted was looking at the impacts of things like the psychopharmaceuticals, the antidepressants that we're taking on fish. And we use fathead minnows as a model, but yeah, some of my colleagues use zebrafish, and there are others that use trout. And the thing about, like I was saying, vertebrates, zebrafish and other fish are vertebrates like us, and they have very similar physiological pathways. And so we anticipate that they might have very similar effects from taking some of these medications. And so when we drop the – but the question is, you know, we take a fairly large dose of these medications. When you find them at these really low concentrations out in the environment, do they still have some kind of effect on the organism? And the main answer to our question is yes, that some of these chemicals do have an impact. And so, for instance, some of the psychopharmaceuticals impact fish reproduction. The fish start behaving differently. The fathead minnows – and we use fathead minnows for this particular research instead of zebrafish because they have kind of an elaborate mating pattern. And what happens is that the male fathead minnow starts acting strange. He becomes kind of obsessive-compulsive about what he's doing and ignores the female to some extent. And some certain doses ends up killing the female, which, of course, is not good for reproduction in a fish or in any organism. And so we are finding that there are some of these compounds that we really should be concerned about and maybe focus on for our treatment technologies.
One of the big worries, I would guess, and Tad, you could weigh in on this, is that a lot of these chemicals that are showing up in our waterways or elsewhere in the environment are relatively recent arrivals on the scene. A lot of these things didn't exist 100 years ago. You know, we didn't have people using deodorant, by the barrel full back in the 1700s or 1800s. Now, going forward, not only are they here, but presumably with population growth, a lot more of this stuff over time will be introduced into the environment.
Right. I think if you go back and look at there's a database that EPA started called the Toxic Substances Control Act database, 1970s, Rebecca, I think it was.
I think so, yeah.
If you look at that database over the past 30 years or so, we've introduced about 3,000 new chemicals each year into that database. Now, those are chemicals used in manufacturing processes. It doesn't include pesticides and herbicides. So we don't know where all these chemicals go once they're used, if they go into the environment at all or if they accumulate in fish. We don't know a lot about their toxicity. So these things are out there. We know that wastewater treatment can't remove everything. And we know very little about all these chemicals.
Well, and remember, I remember growing up as a kid here on the south side of Milwaukee when they were driving through up and down the streets spraying for DDT or spraying DDT to kill mosquitoes. And did anybody know back then that this could have such a dramatic and terrible effect on our birds? A huge issue with our eagles, golden eagles, right? Mm-hmm. And others where the shells were breaking, and we had really not a clue, and that was something that at the time people thought, well, that's just what you do, right? It takes care of one pest.
Yeah, I mean, we have to balance, of course, protecting against other vector-borne diseases that mosquitoes carry and human health. And we know better ways to do that now. But you're right. We didn't know a lot about the toxicity of some of these compounds. And today, what we're finding is that chemicals that we use and then, for example, flush down the drain, they get broken down by microbes in the environment or they get transformed by sunlight. And they can get transformed into more toxic compounds. So triclosan is a very abundant compound that's added to antimicrobial soaps and detergents and whatnot. In the environment, that can get transformed into a known carcinogen, dioxin, and that occurs through UV sunlight.
So this morphing is going – so even if you have the best of intentions, the chemical transformation is something you might not even consider – because it's not happening in that jar of soap, but when it gets out into the environment,
right.
Look out.
Right, and of course, there's other problems associated with using a large amount of an antibiotic. Antimicrobial resistance is one. But also we know now, for example, that pesticides are broken down by microbes into known carcinogens in the environment. So there's a large number of compounds that we may test the toxicity before we use them and say that, well, it's okay, it's not going to harm us. But once it gets out into the environment, it's transformed into something we didn't know about before that is now toxic.
Todd, you've also, I think, received a grant to take a look at algal blooms that are occurring.
That's right.
Tell us about that work.
Sure. So in our inland lakes, not so much in Lake Michigan, but Lake Winnebago, for example, They experience large accumulations of blue-green algae, which people are probably familiar with. And these blue-green algae do produce neurotoxins as well as liver toxins. And every year, people are exposed to these through their recreational activities, and people do get sick occasionally after they swallow some of the water when they're swimming. But what we're looking at is whether or not these chemicals end up in drinking water, and how well our drinking water treatment processes can remove those compounds before people consume that drinking water. And so this is a jointly funded NSF and NIH grant to look at the relationship between water quality in a lake and then the efficiency of drinking water treatment strategies that draws from that lake.
The benefit of this research for the industries, the companies that make that treatment equipment, they've got to be very interested in what you find out.
Sure. So there have been some testing that's been done to show that our drinking water treatment strategies do a very good job of removing some algal toxins, but these algae are like little pharmaceutical factories. They make a large number of different compounds. And so there's a large number of toxins that they make that haven't been investigated. And so we hope to be partnering with some of the manufacturers of drinking water treatment systems to share our data and to show them what works and what doesn't work.
And what a natural place, given the presence of the Water Council with these 150 or so companies here in Wisconsin that are involved in some way in terms of the treatment or the study or the movement or the measuring of water.
Right. One other thing I'll mention is that we're designing buoy sensor systems. So these are buoys that sit out in the lake, and they measure various water quality parameters. And our thinking is that the drinking water treatment operators could be looking at this data from this buoy that comes in real time and assessing their treatment strategies, ramping something up or ramping something down in order to improve the efficiency of treatment.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. Joining us in the studio, Rebecca Clapper. Rebecca is an associate professor at the School of Freshwater Sciences, by the way, the only school of freshwater science in the United States. And Todd Miller, her companion today, is assistant professor in environmental and occupational health at the Zilber School of Public Health. So two different schools, but our two newest schools, and a great example of this interdisciplinary work that is going on. Rebecca, I want to come back to you and talk a little bit more about these nanoparticles that are among the class of emerging contaminants that you're looking at. You also are involved in a significant study, this one taking a look at the impact of these tiny, tiny, tiny little pieces of material that are used in, what, everything from sunscreen, clothing, lots of other things.
Yeah, nanomaterials are kind of a new class of chemicals, so in that kind of that group of new chemicals in the emerging contaminant realm, and they're particulate form, so they're the solid form, and it's less than 100 nanometers in size in any one direction, so smaller than a red blood cell. And because of their small size and their chemical makeup, they have these unique properties so they're being used for all sorts of different things, from drug delivery devices and medicine, because they're smaller than a red blood cell, they can get to places that other things can't, to sunscreens. Titanium dioxide in some of the sunscreens is in a nano form. It's more reflective than its larger counterpart. And it's used for sporting equipment to make it stronger, all sorts of different types of uses. And
how long have they been around?
Well, there are natural nanoparticles out in the environment, so in essence, they've been around forever. But as a field, nanotechnology is relatively new. So it's within the last 10, 15 years that's really blossomed into this huge field of trying to study things down on this nanoscale.
So we're able to, just because of technology evolving, we're now able to manufacture and make things much, much smaller than before.
Yeah, and make these new types of chemicals that have these different reactivity properties. And there have been new ones being developed all the time with different types of chemical properties.
So the plus side is that these tiny little agents, these little pieces of material, are good at attaching to or moving things around. What's the downside?
So the downside is that, like some of these other emerging contaminants that we were talking about, we don't know what kind of impact they might have on the environment. So, you know, if you have something that's really reactive and it's very good for a chemical reaction or for a coating or whatever, it also might be very reactive out in the environment. And so it might interact with an organism, a bacteria, a fish, an algal particle, and cause some kind of negative effect that you don't want because of its reactivity.
So I read a story some time ago about nanoparticles and the fear or the alarm that was being raised by the author was that if these things get into our body or even, like, God forbid, into our brain, there might be some really bad long-term reactions.
Yeah, I think it was a Michael Crichton book, Prey, that kind of blew open the field of nanotoxicology and trying to figure out what these things might do if they're released. And there are some nanorobots being made, so little tiny things that could go, you know, in different places in your body and do things that you want them to do. But I think the great thing about that is that it really spawned this whole field of trying to figure out the environmental health and safety impacts of these new chemical classes that are coming out for nanoparticles, which is unlike what we're talking about with some of these other chemicals or some of our historical chemicals where it was decades later that we decided, well, maybe we need to figure out what kind of impact these things might have if we release them. The nanotoxicology is kind of going along with the development of the chemicals, which is really exciting.
You've got a major grant or participating in a major grant looking at these nanoparticles. Who are your partners?
So we got a grant, a Center for Chemical Innovation grant from NSF. That is looking at sustainable nanotechnology. So how to create these nanomaterials that would be less dangerous and would create the most sustainable way of making these particles into the future. And it's a grant. The lead organization is UW-Madison, but it's a center grant, so it's several universities together. It's Madison, UW-Milwaukee. We have Northwestern, University of Minnesota, and University of Illinois, and we also have collaborators at Pacific Northwest National Lab, which is a DOE facility. And so we have this stage one grant to look at how you could make a nanomaterial that would be safer, basically.
Any sense of how long it will take to get answers?
Well, we're already starting to get some answers. So the first publication was accepted for publication from the researchers at Minnesota and Illinois, and then we should be having something coming out very soon with our collaborators in Illinois. And we're working on a larger paper that incorporates the research from all of the labs together. And so we should be getting some answers right away. It'll take a long time to develop, you know, a larger answer, but some of the small answers are coming along the way about how these things interact with organisms.
A little earlier, Todd talked about the value of his research and how companies that make the equipment that cleans up our water may be very interested in finding out what they need to be looking for. How receptive do you think industry will be to the work that you're doing on nanoparticles?
I think they're very interactive with us right now. So, for instance, in Milwaukee, we have folks from Sigma-Aldrich that are participating in our meetings. I'm on a National Academies panel that's evaluating the federal government research effort in this area. And we have folks that are involved with the nanotechnology industry that are right on our panel with us discussing these issues. So I think it benefits them because then they have strategies for making particles that are safer. They have ways of testing particles to show that they're safe and they're being careful about their industry. And so they're definitely good collaborators in this field.
And how nice that they've got UW-Milwaukee right in their backyard.
Yeah.
It must make that collaboration or communication that much easier.
Exactly. We've already talked about trading students going over there to do research projects or to have internships.
You know, we've been talking so far mainly about these emerging contaminants that that you both of you are studying. Want to back up just a little bit and talk about all the other things that that are part of our culture, part of the environment that we have. Do we know enough about the other non-emerging, the sort of long-standing chemicals or other materials that we manufacture that we by now don't have to worry about them so much can or should focus more on these new emerging contaminants, the things that are coming out of the labs today?
Well, the old stuff is still there. So some people are familiar with trichloroethylene, which was used in dry cleaning as a dry cleaning reagent. That's still there, and it does contaminate groundwater. The nice thing is that we do have ways of treating that these days, and they're fairly robust strategies. For example, with trichloroethylene, there are microbes that we know about that we can culture in the lab, and we can go out to a contaminated aquifer and we can throw in these microbes, and we know how to get them to grow there and to degrade these compounds. Others, such as polychlorinated biphenyls, which a lot of people are familiar with.
PCBs.
PCBs.
Huge problem in Wisconsin rivers coming out of the paper industry.
Right, right. So our best strategy for PCBs is really to pick it up and take it away and put it in a landfill and contain it. We do know about microbes that can degrade PCBs, and there are chemical oxidizers that can degrade PCBs as well. But it takes a long time, and it's very expensive. So the default, for example, in the Hudson River is to dredge it, pull all that stuff out, and contain it somewhere.
And aren't they doing that in the Fox River up near Green Bay, in Appleton, Neenah, Menasha area, too?
Yeah, and so the worry there is that when you're pulling this stuff up and you're dredging it out, that you're actually releasing it into the water column so that, you know, somebody downstream is now exposed to it. So that's a very expensive process, not only the dredging, but then you have to treat the downstream water and make sure that it's not going to contaminate somebody else's drinking water. These things are still around, and they're still a problem for us. But luckily, we are trying to deal with it.
So you're making progress, but we can't forget about all of the existing chemical agents that are already part of our society, because they can still come back to bite us if we don't continue to monitor them.
Yeah,
right. I think there's a distinction here, which is that, you know, academia can make a real contribution by identifying those new compounds, where they are, who they are, and how they're affecting fish and humans. The other compounds that we've already studied, and we know where they are, and we know how to treat them, this is now in sort of a policy and an industry arena. So the industry's now moved in, really taken off with that intellectual property that was garnered several years ago. And now they're developing the strategies and a real robust industry around cleaning these things up.
So this is actually an economic development story in a sense, right? I mean, you're really working hand in hand.
Oh, it is. It's a very large industry cleaning these things up.
A really good example is the triclosan, which we were just mentioning earlier. Is the triclosan breaks down into these dioxin products, which are like the dioxins that have been out there for a while now that we have been trying to get rid of. And the success story is that because of our technologies for getting rid of these things, and when we burn and incinerate, the amount of dioxins of that type have gone down. And it's these new ones that are being recognized by scientists now that are on the increase. And so here we have a story where the environmental cleanup community has done a really good job of decreasing the amount of dioxins in the environment, and the academic community says, well, wait a second, here's some new ones that you need to pay attention to that we need to get rid of.
I know it's hard to believe, but spring is around the corner, and a lot of people are going to be ready to start planting their gardens again. It just occurs to me, as you talk about how these chemicals change and morph, should any of us be concerned as we put our seeds in the ground of what's going to be in the fruit or the vegetables that we eat later if we're not testing the soil?
Well, that is a worry. It's always been a worry. One of the things that we look at is what do you do with the sewage sludge, for example, that's applied to agricultural lands? There's a lot of things in sewage sludge that do end up in soils. For the homeowner, I don't think there's a worry unless
you've got a big truck backing up with waste being dumped on your tiny little plot.
So I don't want to pick on wastewater treatment because they have to get rid of their sewage sludge somehow, and this is really a beneficial reuse of a product that is building up. But it is a problem because sewage sludge contains a large number of different chemicals that can be taken up by plants and transported up to the leaves and beans. And that's been shown for now triclosan and triclocarban, these two antimicrobials that are present in soaps and detergents.
Well, tell you what, I'm going to sleep better knowing that both of you are studying these problems and others like your colleagues are looking at it. And so I'm going to plant my seeds anyway and just not worry about it this year.
You send it over to the lab, Tom. I'll analyze it for you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Fascinating conversation. We'll continue to monitor both of your two research projects, and we'll invite you back to share with us the results as they come in.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Rebecca Clapper and Todd Miller, our guest on this edition of UWM Today, both colleagues, both collaborators, one in freshwater science, the other in public health, as we learn about the story and problems or challenge of emerging contaminants. That's all for this week's edition of UWM Today. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week at the same time. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.